about Randy Doak. Randy.
All right.
Take your pick, my friend. One of those is an ace. Which one are you going to pick? That's the one. You win.
All right.
Good job. Thank you.
I can separate.
Okay, thank you. How about David Spainhauer? Spainhauer?
Yes.
Come on in. This is not a stacked deck, but there's still two aces left. Yeah. You get to pick.
$1 million.
You're not telling me. Okay, thank you very much. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, looks like I'm
going
to have to buy books.
Not yet. Are you Nick Finelli?
Nope.
Where is Nick Finelli? Nick, where are you?
Right there.
Good. All right, Nick, you made it easy. Congratulations. Thank you. Is the CD all loaded up?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
We are recording.
All right. Hugh, it's all yours again. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, I want to go back to the global warming. I'm from one of the Pacific islands that are sinking. And I just want to know what is the sinking rate. That way I can inform my relatives to sell the islands before they all go under.
Yeah, the sea levels are rising slowly, but quite slowly. We're talking inches since the Industrial Revolution, so it's not even yet up 1 foot. But, for example, where I grew up in British Columbia, the Vancouver airport, there is no place on Sea Island that's more than 2 feet above sea level. So if the sea level rises by 2 feet, that island will be gone. So, yeah, there are places in the world where even a foot rise of sea level would make a difference. And that could happen as early as the end of this century. By the way, during the last ice age, the sea level rose 330 feet. So, but we're close to maximum sea level right now.
Another write-in question, Hugh. It's one I haven't heard before, so I'm interested in your answer. After you are resurrected and you are in the new creation, which I know you believe in, how much of your personality and what do you think your body will be like in heaven? How much of your personality, how much of your body will be left in heaven?
Well, the body I'm going to have will be an incorruptible body, and it'll be a body with no signs of age or wear on it. So I'm not expecting to have gray hair or a bald head in the new creation, or chipped teeth or scar tissue. And, you know, my physical capability will be maximal. So, yeah, that sounds really good. And, you know, in terms of the personality, it will be different, because it tells us in 1 Corinthians 3, verses 12 through 15, that before you go receive your new body and enter into the, you know, heaven, you go through a refining fire. And the refining fire is not a judgment. It's basically a stripping away from your personality everything that makes you obnoxious to other human beings. And by the way,
you're not going to be sitting next to a beautiful lady.
Now, every one of us has parts of our personality that are obnoxious to other human beings. So we all share in that, which is why every one of us has got to go through a refining fire. And if you read 1 Corinthians 3, some of us get refined a little more than others, because some of us are a little more obnoxious than others. But all of us have some degree of obnoxiousness that needs to be burnt away. And so that means when you enter into the new creation and you meet another Christian, it's going to be the most fascinating relationship you can imagine. There will be no boring Christians in the new creation. And you're going to want to spend time with everybody in the new creation because of just how wonderful their personality is. Now, we're all going to have different personalities. So what makes you distinctive as a human being in terms of your personality gets preserved. But the noxious part, that all gets taken away. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to cringe when some Christian comes towards me, the new creation. That's not going to happen. That might happen when you go to church on Sunday morning, but it's not going to happen in the new creation.
Can we do fringe, strange? Is that all right?
Can we do what?
Fringe, strange questions?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, good. There is a group called Skywatch Television. They do prophetic. They have a prophetic ministry. They've come up with a DVD called Inhuman. I don't know if you've heard of it or not. Their contention is when Jesus is talking about the second coming, and he says, as was in the days of Noah. Their take on this is in the days of Noah, there were Rephaim and Nephilim, and they had mated with the daughters of Earth, and they had successfully corrupted God's creation, the genome. And now we are now entering into another stage like that where they apparently you can buy a home genetics kit called a CRISPR that comes with vials in it that intravenously you can change genetics. So their contention is that we are now in the days of second days of Noah by corrupting God's creation and his genome, which incurred his wrath the first time and undoubtedly will do so again.
Yeah, it's a little overstated. What CRISPR allows you to do is to get a genetic map of your genome efficiently and quickly. So actually for a small price, you can have someone map your genome and kind of figure out what your genetic makeup is. So that's within the realm of technology today. The idea that someone could give you a shot and change all your DNA, no, that's not the case. Could that conceivably happen in the future? Not in the conceivable future is that technology within our grasp. You know, it makes great science fiction, but in terms of it being practical. Now, what may be practical is that there's research going on where they can use viruses to infect you and correct genetic defects in your body. We're close to being able to do that. So that might be a good reason to thank God for viruses when you have your Thanksgiving dinner. So so that could actually happen. So, and then there's been speculation that people might be able to use the same technology to do genetic enhancements, and that's where you get into the Frankenstein monster scenarios. So, but really the geneticists are saying is one thing to correct a genetic problem is quite another thing to try to improve what we already have. And by the way, that's not new. Scientists literally for decades have been, quote, trying to improve upon the human body. But all of our evidence is telling us you're better off leaving it alone. Because what we really have is something that's optimally designed. And when we humans try to mess with it to improve it, we always make it worse. Which basically is telling us God created our human bodies in optimal form. Now, it is true that our bodies are subject to the laws of physics, which cause things to decay and break down. A lot of us here are evidence of that decay and breakdown. I'm personally part of that crowd. I mean, that happens. So, yes. Now, some of these people, I'm not sure if it's the individual you're talking about, but I've seen a lot of stuff on television from these Bible prophecy people claiming that the Rephaim or the Nephilim are coming back. Some even claim they're already here. And I see no biblical support for that. God raised up David's mighty men to wipe out the last of the Nephilim. And so for the last 3,000 years, there hasn't been any. Moreover, there's a verse in Jude 6 that tells us that if any fallen angel were to dare to try to bring that back, they get a quick one-way ticket to the abyss. And they don't like the abyss, evidently. And so that keeps them from repeating the damage that they did that we see in Genesis 6. And, by the way, I don't see any humans or human-like creatures running around that are 9 foot nine plus. But the shortest of the Nephilim mentioned in the Bible is Goliath. He was the smallest of the Nephilim that are mentioned. And he was at least 9 foot 9 inches tall. So if you don't see anybody like that running around, I wouldn't worry about the Rephaim.
This is the strange question time right now.
Yeah, strange question time's fine.
Okay.
By the way, next week I'm doing one of these UFO shows on the radio, so this will be perfect preparation.
Now, I'd just like to know the implications. I don't know that much about it, but I hear about the tests they're doing at CERN in Switzerland on the hydrogen collider and the
right.
dark matter. What's that all about?
Okay, that's the Large Hadron Collider. It's the most energetic particle accelerator that's been built by humanity. Also ranks as the most expensive science experiment ever undertaken by humanity. $10 billion, and it takes $1 billion a year to sustain it. So that's a lot of money. But what they're doing is trying to use that instrument to get a deeper understanding of particle creation. And to me, what's exciting, what's happening at CERN, is fitting what we astronomers are doing with respect to trying to understand cosmic creation. And so the research of the universe at the largest possible scale is actually compatible with what we're discovering at the smallest scale, thanks to the CERN Large Hadron Collider. Now, there are rumors running around that CERN will be able to achieve energy density so extreme they'll be able to make a black hole, and that could possibly suck the entire Earth into it. That rumor is unfounded. They do not have that kind of energy density capability. And by the way, there's no risk that the energy densities they are achieving are going to cause a catastrophe. Why? We already see those energy densities in other galaxies. And they're not causing anything like the catastrophes that are being rumored on the internet. So in other words, we already know what happens at those energy densities. So you can rest assured that nothing's going to happen to you by some exotic experiment going on at the Large Hadron Collider. What is exciting is that we're going to learn a lot more about the unification of the forces of physics. The Large Hadron Collider gets us a lot closer to understanding that moment when the strong electroweak force was one force. By the way, previous particle accelerators have fully explored how the universe goes from three forces of physics to four forces of physics. That's been totally experimentally investigated. And the Large Hadron Collider is going to give us some understanding of the transition from two forces of physics to three forces of physics. Some, not complete. To a complete understanding, we would need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long. And the one in CERN is only 17 miles long. So it's going to fall short by a little bit.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just wondering now with how we have, you know, cars that operate from batteries and other kinds of ways that are combustible to operate a car other than using gasoline. And, you know, now gasoline's really cheap. I think that's probably because, in part, people are figuring out there are other ways that they can get around rather than using gasoline. So if God allowed, when God allowed all of the dinosaurs, you know, to die and expire and eventually deteriorate into what we now use is to make gasoline, right, or other products, what happens if we just decide we're not going to use the entire, you know, flooded plains of gasoline out there? Because I think a lot of it's really never been touched, you know, they're... There's a lot under Saudi Arabia. You talked to us about that in Alaska, probably under the oceans. I don't know. But does that use or not use speed along our eventual demise, or it really is kind of just there's nothing to it?
Well, we've been able to launch civilization at a high-tech level because of the availability of fossil fuels at a cheap price. And, that will give us a sufficient time that we can generate alternate forms of energy. I mean, people speak about, wouldn't it be great if we have fusion power? That will give us near limitless energy. But the goal of getting fusion power would be unattainable if we didn't have access to the fossil fuels. We have access to the fossil fuels thanks to hundreds of millions of years of plant and animal life that preceded us here on planet Earth. For what it's worth, most of the gasoline we got comes from shellfish rather than dinosaurs. Dinosaurs do contribute a little, but only a tiny percentage. It's basically shellfish. I mean, you heard of shell oil? Well, the reason why they call it shell oil, that's where a lot of the oil comes from. So
the commercial with the dinosaur in your tank is not accurate.
Well, maybe a little bit of the dinosaur, but only a little bit.
Yeah. So the other thing you have to point out, Hugh, is batteries are not a source of energy. You have to use fossil fuels to charge those batteries.
Well, that's true. People talk about making cars run with electricity. The electricity's got to come from somewhere. Or the idea of having cars run with hydrogen. The hydrogen's got to be made with electricity. And so unless you've got very cheap forms of hydropower, you're really making a bigger carbon footprint with battery-operated cars. I mean, people have noted that. The Prius actually has a bigger carbon footprint than an efficient gasoline engine because you got the battery. You got to make the battery. It takes energy. The battery doesn't last long. You got to recycle the battery. It's not easy to recycle. And what are you getting? Maybe a 20% increase in gas mileage. And that's not enough to compensate for all the extra carbon you got to consume to maintain the technology. So, and likewise, people say, well, look at all the radioactivity you get from fission nuclear power. But if you decide to burn coal instead of using nuclear power plants, you actually release more radioactivity in the environment by burning coal than you do with nuclear fission. However, if you go with nuclear fusion, you could potentially get almost limitless energy with no radioactivity and no carbon footprint. So far, I remember when I was an undergraduate student, my professors were saying we're 10 years away from having fusion power cheaply available. And every 10 years, they say it's 10 years away. So
what stops it?
Well, what stops it is you basically have to duplicate the energy conditions inside the sun, because that's a gigantic nuclear bomb. It's a stable nuclear bomb because of all the gravity of the sun. Well, we're not going to be able to duplicate the gravity of the sun to make a stable nuclear furnace, so we're trying to do electromagnetic radiation. But trying to use electromagnetic radiation to make a stable, high energy density cavity that we can draw electricity from, that's technologically extremely difficult. I mean, they're now actually got reactors, fusion reactors, where they get as much energy out as they put in. But that's not an economically viable energy source if you have to put just as much energy in as you get out. That's a zero sum. But my friends who are involved in that research, they're also telling me we're close. We just simply have to scale up. Yeah. So we'll see.
Something else that seems to be really close any day is us going to Mars. Seems like we're like 5-10 years away sometimes. What do you see as the biggest challenge or obstacle for us to get to Mars?
The biggest challenge of us getting to Mars is to convince NASA not to send human beings. I mean, the farther away you go, the more challenging it is to maintain the safety and the health of the astronaut. Keep in mind, with the Apollo program, we only left the astronauts there for 3 days. And also, when you're going to the moon, you're partly protected by the Earth's Van Allen belts. And also, if we're talking 3 days, you can actually watch the physics of the sun and figure out the time when you've got the least radiation exposure to get to the moon and back. So, for example, if there's a gigantic solar flare, it takes 24 hours before the radiation hits the orbit of the Earth. So you could technically have people on the moon and say, hey, solar flare's happening. We're going to get you back home in short order. If you're on Mars, you're not going to be able to do that. There's no way you're going to get people back in 24 hours. And so there's a bigger risk. And by the way, I think it would be too much of a challenge to have a permanent human habitation on the moon. If you got a permanent human habitation on the moon, they are going to get exposed to radiation. And one of the things they discovered is what they call the dust problem. You probably heard of silicosis, that if you're a coal miner, and if you're breathing in fine coal dust, it's going to give you lung disease that will kill you. While the dust that we see on Mars and the dust on the moon also will kill you. And the problem with that dust is it's hard to shake off. So, you probably saw the movie The Martian, and it shows a guy there with a spacesuit wandering around on Mars, and he goes into his habitat. He takes his spacesuit off, takes his helmet off. That's not realistic. He would have to go in a cavity and somehow have all the dust electrostatically removed from his spacesuit before he could take his spacesuit off. And that would require really sophisticated equipment, and it would take many hours. So you'd have to have the astronaut sitting there for hours while the dust is staying. Even then, there's no guarantee he'd get all the dust off. And if you breathe in that dust, it's going to do you significant damage. So in the case of Mars, you not only have solar radiation that's an issue, you've got cosmic radiation. The cosmic radiation there is going to be much more harmful than it is here on Earth. There's no magnetic field to shield you. The other problem you've got with Mars is that the gravity is not the same as the Earth. It's 40% of the Earth. And you've probably seen the astronauts hopping around on Mars. The only way you can stably move around on Mars is to do kind of a bunny hop. If you tried to walk like you do here on Earth, you would fall over, and you may not be able to get yourself back up. So that would be a big problem. While on Mars, you've got a little more gravity, so you're a little more mobile on Mars than you would be on Earth, but it's still not like walking around here on Earth. We need the gravity of the Earth to be as mobile as we are. So you might say, gee, because of gravity, I have to work harder. But because of gravity, you're able to be bipedal and stable in a very comfortable way. Change the gravity. And by the way, you can go up to the NASA facility in the Bay Area. I'm trying to remember what it's called, Ames. And they actually have places there where you can go in and feel what it's like to walk around under Martian gravity or lunar gravity. And I've done it. Your body, you do not have that much control over your body. It's a really eerie feeling. So, and by the way, if you live at 40% gravity for several months, it will do damage to your body. Because your body basically adapts to that gravity and figures out, I don't need the bone mass. And your body will actually lose bone mass. And when you come back to the Earth, you will not have adequate bone mass to survive. So, and they discovered that with the space station. In order to keep the astronauts alive when they get back on Earth, when they go into the space station, they have to run a treadmill where they've got these bungee cords. And the bungee cords are designed to simulate Earth gravity. So they're running against these bungee cords. But in order to keep the bone mass loss down to 1% per month, they have to exercise for 4 hours a day. And I've talked to people who have done it. They said it takes tremendous discipline to run on this treadmill for 4 hours a day with these bungee cords hanging on to you. They said it's the most boring thing you can imagine. And everything tempts you to get off the machine. But that's what it takes just to keep the bone mass loss down to 1%. And by the way, that 1% bone mass loss is not recoverable. When you come back to the Earth, it's permanent. So if you're up there for 6 months, you lose 6% of your bone mass and will not come back.
Yeah, it's not just bone, it's also muscle.
You'll lose muscle as well.
He was in Mir for a year. He was in physical therapy for 6 months before he could just walk a couple steps.
Yeah, and he died because he didn't have the bone mass and muscle mass he needed to keep living here on Earth. So there are risks. And by the way, Mars is also a place where every couple of years they get a dust storm. And when they get a dust storm, you've got dust and boulders moving at 300 miles per hour. So you don't want to be outside when that happens. For that matter, you don't want to be inside either, because whatever you're inside of is going to get destroyed. And so you'd have to actually have your human habitat underground. So you'd be protected from the radiation and the dust storms. But then you've got a problem. You don't have the gravity you need. Bottom line is, we can do far more with machines than we can do with human beings. Machines will give us way more science than a human explorer will give us. And you can send literally thousands of machines to Mars for the price of what it costs to send human beings. And if you lose a machine, well, we just send up another one. But I don't think it's really ethical to send human beings to Mars on a one-way trip. So, and that's what you're looking at. You really have no guarantee you can bring them back alive.
I don't know if this is a fringe question, but you know about Nikola Tesla?
Yes.
I understand he was credited with creating the AC electricity, and Edison was the champion of DC, and there
Correct.
Was this big fight, and Tesla actually proved that his was right, but there was a lot of things that went on, but he was doing those experiments, and I want to know what you think about this. He says you could reach out and grab the electricity from the atmosphere. They call it the ether.
Right.
And you could harness that, and it would be free to everybody. Well, in a capitalist society, especially Edison, are you kidding? No, we're going to make money on this energy, creating this energy. And I think Tesla was brilliant, of course. What do you think about this?
Tesla was into a lot of really weird stuff. I mean, talk about fringe physics. He was into a lot of it, and even into some occultic stuff.
Oh.
So, and he had this idea that maybe we could get free electricity from the Earth's magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, theoretically, that's possible. The problem is the Earth's magnetic field is just too weak to get any significant energy generation. Now, if you go down to Mexico, what you'll see is that the Mexicans actually have wires right underneath the power lines, because by induction, you can get energy off of the power line. So, and by the way, you can do that here, too. But if you do, Edison's going to get after you, because you're basically stealing energy off their transmission lines.
It's like a vampire, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, in third world countries, that's frequently done, where people will kind of put out a line of wire and use induction to bleed energy off of the transmission lines. But trying to bleed it off the Earth's magnetic field, yeah, you're not going to get enough energy to pay for it. Not even close.
I see. Thank you.
In India, there's a individual, his name is Amit Goswami. He's a physicist. He wrote a book called The Quantum Activist. And he, I saw his whole video. I was very impressed with the idea that through quantum physics, it shows that there's consciousness within the physics itself, because it's got this weird thing where there's nothing that's really consistent, but an atom would spin one way or an electron would spin, and then in New York it would change direction automatically. So he comes up with the theory that there's consciousness within the physics.
Yeah, he's not alone in that kind of hypothesis. A number of physicists in Europe as well as Asia have speculated that maybe the source of consciousness would be quantum microtubules within the cells and the neurons. It's speculation. They're basically taking advantage of the quantum, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us there's things that we cannot know at the quantum level. And so some physicists speculate, since we cannot know, maybe strange things happen in that region we cannot know. Now, the fallacy is there, you're trying to argue for a position and what we don't know, rather than trying to argue for a position and what we don't know. And when it comes to consciousness, I've got like 50 books in my library on attempts by non-theists to explain consciousness by physical means. But the Bible tells us that the consciousness within us is non-physical. It's not part of the physics and the chemistry. It's a non-physical component. And we see it in the higher animals. We see it in human beings. But if you look at the 50 books I got, basically the people who write these books say, we have no idea physically where consciousness comes from. But the fact that they tried so hard basically should push you towards the conclusion the cause must be non-physical, not physical, because every physical avenue we pursued does not work.
Another way to phrase that, Hughes, that I say is when we study the brain and look at the hardware, the hardware doesn't give us everything that we see that our human body is capable of doing, correct?
That is correct. And a couple of books that have been written by one of the physicists who actually speculated about the quantum microtubules, Roger Penrose, he made the point, when you look at the human brain, the hardware is not adequate to explain all the software capabilities that the brain actually is able to express. And he says the biggest unknown is trying to explain the programming capabilities of the human brain. So he basically makes the point, the brain is not just a computer. It's not only a computer with hardware, it's got software. And not only is there software, there's a programmer there. And it's the programming part that is a consciousness. And there simply isn't enough hardware in the brain to explain everything that it does. Not even close.
Or more amazing, if you have a damage to one part of your brain, it will reprogram other part of your brains to help compensate for it, which is totally amazing.
That is, yes. So that's how
I work on computers, and I wish my computers could do that. It'd make my job a lot easier.
Well, that's what's interesting. Any of you who've done programming will realize it's one thing to write a piece of software that works if there's no failures in the code. But say you generate a 1% failure rate in your lines of code, it's not going to work. And by the way, I've got friends who've tried to write sophisticated computer programs that are, quote, error tolerant, where you can randomly destroy, say, 0.1% of the lines of code and it still functions. What you discover is you've got to write 100 times as much code to make it that error tolerant. And yet this is something we see ubiquitously over the human body, is it has this capability of functioning in spite of errors that are generated. And by the way, errors will be generated because we live in a universe with entropy. And so our brain is able to function even though brain cells continue dying. Well, that's the equivalent to a sophisticated computer programming being able to run where you take lines of code out randomly and throw them away. No one's ever written a computer program that can do that unless it's something very simple and straightforward, like calculating the number pi to a few decimal places. That's a very straightforward, easy computer program. And you can actually write it, so if you kind of throw out a line, it still works. But you've got to write literally hundreds of more lines of code.
Hugh, our time is up.
Our time's up. All right.
Could you close us out in prayer, and we'll thank everybody for coming.
I'll do that, and we do this typically 3 or 4 times a year, so we'll be announcing when this will happen again. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the privilege of living in the 21st century when both in theology and science, there's such rapid advance taking place. And Father, I pray that you would give us the capacity as we leave here to answer people's questions. Lord, that we can encourage them to pursue a pathway of increasing knowledge of your truth. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.